Okay, thanks. Nice to be here, as always. Yeah, so I'm gonna be talking about effects of magnetic fields in supergravity solutions, trying to construct these things and study them. This is work I've been doing with my UCLA colleague, Eric Doker, over the past few months. A couple papers are out already, and one to appear shortly, I hope. Okay, so here's an overview. So the goal is to study gravity solutions holographically dual to 3+1 dimensional gauge theories. I'll say a little bit about 2+1 dimensional case at finite charge density and in background magnetic field. Okay, so a few motivations for this. Well, one motivation, just because it's there, this is a very the kind of theories I'll be looking at, just Einstein-Maxwell theory in five dimensions is sort of one of the most universal sectors of ADS-CFT. And studying charge density in that theory in a background magnetic field is kind of the natural problem, natural generality. So it's just a very natural thing to study, and in fact, it hasn't been studied before, so good. And of course, we have eye to various applications. A lot of discussion these days on condensed matter applications of holography, and certainly in condensed matter systems, you want to be able to turn on a charge density and magnetic field. Those are some of your basic variables that control. There's also, I won't have anything to say about this, but possible QCD applications. There's been some interest lately in these collisions at RIC, where you have some enormous magnetic field generated, and through various anomaly effects and so forth, you can actually claim you can see topological fluctuations, this drives charge separation and so forth. So if you'd like to study that in ADS-CFT, you'd like to have solutions at non-zero charge and in magnetic fields, and so these would be useful for that. Okay, then there's some sort of conceptual angle to this, status of black hole, of extremal black hole entropy, and relation to some sort of possible Nernst theorem that would be there on the CFT side. I'll say a bit more about this, but here, one way of doing this, we can start from some electrically charged black hole, which certainly is a nice extremal limit with non-zero entropy, and add a magnetic field to that and see what that does to the entropy, and see if it removes it or not, or what happens. Okay, so let me get going. Right, so the basic, everything is going to be in the context of Einstein-Maxwell theory, mostly in five dimensions. So we have metric, gauge field, negative cosmological constant. And if we're in odd space, nine dimensions, the Chern-Simons term, which will play a crucial role in five dimensions, as it turns out. Right, so this is a very universal sector because it often, if you start from the whole entire string theory, supergravity, version, you can often consistently truncate that full theory down to this sector, which is you have an infinite number of fields in your theory, but no matter what these fields do, it's consistent to set the other guys to zero, so you can study this. And what that means from the CFT point of view is you can study all correlation functions on the stress tensor, the boundary current that's dual to the gauge field, and you can do this consistently without having to worry about other operators. And so you can study a lot of thermodynamics, you know, transport of the currents and so forth. Okay, so let's start from the simplest solution. So the very simple solution, of course, is just ADS, and then you can make that finite temperature and have the ADS-Schwarzschild solution. The simplest solution involving the gauge field is just the charged black brain solution. So this is basically the ADS version of the Reiser-Nordström solution. And everything I'll be talking about here in this talk, the boundary, in other words, where the CFT lives, is always going to be a plane. So I have a planar boundary, you could generalize it to spheres or hyperboloids, whatever, but it's always going to be a sphere here. Okay, so this is a well-known solution, a very simple solution in terms of this function U of R, which is parametrized by the energy density of the solution and the charge density Q, and there's some radially pointing electric field. And this thing's nicely asymptotically ADS and exists as a solution of Einstein-Maxwell in any dimension. Okay, well, what are the entropy of these solutions behave like at very high temperatures? You can basically forget about the fact that there was an electric charge there that's subdominant, and then the entropy just scales like some power of T, basically just given by dimensional analysis, so T to the D if you're in D spatial dimensions. It's got to do this. Then you come down in temperature, and it's of course very well known, as you go to zero temperature, the entropy stabilizes at some non-zero value proportional to the charge density. And you get some smooth extremal limit. The entropy density is proportional to the charge density. These things are non-supersymmetric in general. And like extremal black holes like to do, this thing has some near horizon ADS-2 factor, in this case times a plane. And this sort of thing, of course, has played an important role in recent discussions of Fermi surfaces and so forth.
Sure. At low temperature, since it's, would it go through, is it actually flat coming in? Because, in a 1 plus 0 dimensional system, the degree goes T to the 0.
This is not drawn according to any, this is just a random hand drawing. What does it actually do, ds by this one?
Entropy when you're in T would be like one space dimension, or am I getting confused?
Yeah, that is one, so that'll appear, yeah.
This is zero space in the test?
Yeah. I'm not sure, so this may not be accurate here, this drawing.
It's an extra pathological bit. Not only is finite as t equals zero, but is sort of doesn't change.
I'm not. I don't remember actually. Okay. Now this entropy that exists at t equals zero is very puzzling from many perspectives, but one especially from the point of view of the dual CFT. In the various gauge theories that we know are dual to these kinds of black holes, they're generically charged bosons in the theory, and at least if our weak coupling intuition is correct, if you have some massless charged bosons, you turn on a chemical potential, well, you just get Bose condensation. The zero mode of the bosons just eats all the charge. That's gone, and so you'd expect the resulting theory just to have zero entropy because the charge has basically disappeared. Obviously not what's happening here. And then from the point of view of comparing with realistic systems, of course, one thing we're learning about in our stat-met classes is Nernst's theorem, or the third law of thermodynamics. And of course, these aren't quote marks, as they're neither theorems nor laws. They're really phenomenological statements about, and you need more quote marks, generic systems. Okay, so it's some sort of rule of thumb, which seems to apply in various cases. And the reason the quote marks is, of course, it's trivial to construct counterexamples of this just based on free systems. There's a bunch of free spins or whatever. You can make the entropy as large as you want, no problem. But the point is supposed to be those kind of theories supposed to be thought to be very fine-tuned. As soon as you introduce a little bit of interaction between the spins, that would lift the degeneracy. You'd have some unique ground state. So how could we potentially view this sort of statement in light of ADS-CFT? Well, so in ADS-CFT, it could be the case that those kind of extremal black holes we discussed there could be viewed as some fine-tuned system. And so if I like to ask, is it fine-tuned? Well, you'd like to add in some generic kind of interactions. And of course, you'd like to modify Lagrangian by some generic collection of operators. And of course, in ADS-CFT, we're going to do that. The lambda I's, the couplings, just become boundary conditions for whatever fields you have in your theory. So one could ask whether the entropy of the extremal black hole survived changes in boundary conditions for whatever fields you have in your theory. And so if it was true that the entropy was to be thought as being fine-tuned, you have some sort of picture like this. So without, just with L, with none of these couplings, the entropy would be this red curve here coming down to non-zero entropy. And if you turn on the couplings, it would come down at high temperatures, would look the same, but eventually the presence of these other couplings would show up and they would drive the entropy down to zero. And so this would be, you could think of the entropy as being sort of unstable in some sort of renormalization group sense. You end up on this different trajectory if you're infinitesimally far away from the red curve. Okay, so there are many different kinds of, you can imagine testing this in many different ways, and that's something I'm sort of involved in doing. But one angle on this is, here we're going to be looking at some perturbation corresponding to a magnetic field. So we can ask about how does the entropy respond to some small magnetic field. Okay, so that brings us indeed to magnetic fields. So now we want to look for supergravity solutions that have some boundary magnetic field. And again, from the point of view of the CFT, this is the gauge field of some external gauge field, and we're just fixing a constant value of that guy. And so for the bulk Maxwell field, we'd like some spatial components tangent to the boundary to go to a constant as we approach the ADS boundary. That corresponds to some constant magnetic field in the CFT. Okay, well, let's start with the simplest case, dispense with that quickly. This case is kind of, in a sense, trivial. This is the case where we're in four space-time dimensions in the bulk. Okay, so we wrote down before the charged black brain solution, ADS-4. And if we have electromagnetism in four dimensions, of course, we can just do a duality rotation. And so starting with just the purely electrically charged field strength, let's do a duality rotation. That turns on a constant B. And what do you do to the solution? Well, before I had some q squareds, I just replaced them by q squared plus b squared. That's the duality invariant combination. and you're done. And so, of course, this, if the original solution had grounds in entropy, this one's also going to have grounds in entropy. Just replace q squared by q squared plus b squared. Okay, so this is the famous dynamic black brain solution that's popped up in various contexts. So let me come back to this. So we said before, when he had no vanishing B field, this entropy is a function going linear in Q was, I think, pretty mysterious from the point of view of the CFT. Are you helped at all when you introduce the magnetic field? So one thing you could do now is thinking about taking the opposite limit. Let's turn off the electric charge and just keep the magnetic field. According to this, we have entropy going like B. And so there you can do somewhat better. You can kind of make sense of why there should be such entropy. So let's just look at this from the point of view of free field theory. Let's just, whatever the dual field theory is the bulk, let's just take the weak coupling limit and compare that with the previous entropy, the entropy to some system of tuples of one-dimensional charge bosons and fermions moving in this background magnetic field. Okay, so they're massless charged particles. We have some, you know, relativistic Landau level problem. I just write down standard formula here for the energy levels of massless charged particles in a magnetic field. Okay, for the bosons and the fermions, and is ranging over 0, 1, 2, etc. As you well know, the degeneracy of the Landau level is basically proportional to the amount of flux through the system, so a magnetic field times the area. And so importantly, the bosons start off at non-zero energy. So you stick an n equals 0 here, you have a non-zero energy for the lowest state. For fermions, you have n equals 0, you have a zero energy state. Of course, so these, you have these zero mode fermions, these are the ones that you knew had to be there by, if you like, the Dirac, the index of the Dirac operator. And okay, so now you have these zero energy states, and that's a perfect place to find entropy. So you can just start filling up all these fermion zero modes in any distribution you'd like. And well, since the number of these fermions goes like b, I mean the entropy is going to have to be proportional to b, clearly. Okay, so at q equal to zero, non-zero b, you get an entropy that goes like b. As we did in supergravity, so that's good. It's pretty generic. Yeah, of course the number would depend, and of course on the spectrum. Yeah. And even if you had a particular system, there's no reason to expect that the numbers would match. But it's the scale. I mean, it's the fact that you get something non-zero here, I think, which is
the point. Isn't the non-zero unit there interacting bosons?
Not necessarily. Yeah. There's no guarantee that.
It's just an example. It doesn't mean this is stable or typical in this.
No, the generally could definitely be lifted by interactions.
For real Landau levels,
yeah.
I mean, there are Coulomb forces. They do lift them, don't they? They sphere out the sharp band into a...
I think they would, yeah. I don't actually know the answer, but I don't see any reason why. There's no symmetry to protect them.
Right.
So I assume they would, yeah. Okay. Now you could try now adding, now you've done well, it's Q equals zero. You could add on some charge now. And, of course, you're not going to get agreement here between that simple S equals like square root of Q squared plus B squared. There's no reason why the free field theory just depends on Q squared plus B squared. So you could compute some coefficients. But anyway, things are going to get worse, and eventually things are going to break down completely. When the chemical potential gets to be a square root B, that's when the chemical potential is so large, and now the bosons indeed are going to condense. So at large B, I mean, the bosons were lifted, but if the chemical potential is high enough, then you get above that lowest level the bosons, and then they condense, and then you have no hope. Okay, so that's the that's all I wanted to say about the four-dimensional case. Okay, now to five dimensions. Here things are a lot richer, a lot more interesting, and more difficult as well. So now we're looking at Einstein, Maxwell, crucially Chern-Simons theory. So the Chern-Simons term on the one hand basically plays the role, accounts for the anomaly of the global currents, the R currents in the CFT, and K, the coefficient here, is basically the strength of the anomaly. So a lot of the talk, I'm just going to keep K variable, just deal with general K, but if you want this action to be the bosonic part of supergravity with this matter content, with this bosonic matter content, you're fixed to a particular value. K has to be 2 over square root 3 in these particular conventions. Okay. Now again, this is an extremely universal action because in fact it's been proven that any ADS5 background supersymmetric that comes from some sort of 2B or M theory compactification admits a consistent truncation down to this theory. So you can study a lot in this theory, and what you study from this theory applies to a huge class of CFTs. So it's, you get a lot of mileage out of this stuff. Okay, so let me first look at uncharged solutions. So just solutions carrying a magnetic field, but no charge. Of course, we know the solutions with no magnetic field and charge. Okay, and again, the boundary here is flat. So the magnetic field is going to be, in terms of form notation, filling the 1-2 plane. And so, you know, 1 and 2 come together here, and then the 3 direction is singled out. We just write down a general metric here and some choice of coordinates, some general metric consistent with the symmetries. The problem is with these two functions, three functions, u, v, and w. And we want to find asymptotically ADS5 solutions of this theory. Okay, so you put in the equations in terms of u and v and w. They don't look really too bad, but it's definitely a true statement to say it's very challenging to find analytical results. Okay, I don't really know if it's not possible, but you can eventually map these things down, the equations down to something where they have a name. You can find that these things have been called something somewhere, but there's no solution. And indeed, these things are everything's non-supersymmetric here. The magnetic field's breaking the supersymmetry. In principle, you can have magnetic fields consistent with supersymmetry if you have a curved boundary and you set the curvature proportional to the gauge field, the field strength, and you can cancel off the holonomies that way. But this is non-supersymmetric. Okay, so, well, instead of starting from the fully asymptotic ADS5 solutions, why not look for a near-horizon solution, first of all? And indeed, this theory emits a very simple near-horizon solution written down here. And what is this? Well, so this is just R2, and then these three, R, T, and X3, you can see combined to give ADS3. Okay, so there's an ADS3 times R2 near-horizon solution, again, with this Maxwell field. And by the same token, if you'd like to, you can place that ADS3 by BTZ black hole at no cost. So you can heat the thing up just very easily. Okay, now, so you encounter an ADS3 solution. What's the first thing you do? Well, the first thing I would do is compute the central charge. Okay, so take Brown-Hanault formula, compute the central charge, given in terms of the ADS3 radius, the three-dimensional Newton's constant, which is in turn gotten from the five-dimensional Newton's constant, et cetera. And let's write this thing out in a way that we can compare it to gauge theory. So I put in the factors of n squared and so on. Okay, so BV2 is basically the amount of magnetic flux in the system. Okay, and so now it's fun to compare, again, with the free gauge theory, in this case, free n equals 4 Subriang-Mills theory in a constant background magnetic field. Okay, so again, part of the problem involves some lambda-level problem. But now, of course, we have one extra spatial direction compared to what we had before. So in the directions 1, 2, you get these quantized orbits. Everything there is discrete. But then you have the continuous momentum parallel to B in the 3 direction. Okay, so these zero modes now become 1 plus 1-dimensional massless fields. So at low energies, you just have these fermion zero modes with momentum in the 3 direction. And so the theory is going to flow down effectively some 1 plus 1-dimensional CFT. Sort of partially imagining you're sort of compactifying the directions 1 and 2, so I have a finite amount of flux, and then in that case I really do have a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. So what is the central charge of that CFT? Well, we just count up the number of zero modes and just count up the number of fermions. So the CFT just has fermions and nothing else. Count up the number of fermions, and for technical reasons, B here is actually the magnetic field that's naturally normalized in the gauge theory, and you have to convert that to the normalization I was using up here. So there's some factors that show up there, but let's not dwell too much on that. So at the end of the day, central charge is some sum over the spectrum of fermions in your theory, and we're just using the degeneracy of lambda levels, being proportional to the amount of flux. You put in the numbers, and then eventually what you find is that the central charge in n equals 4 is actually square root 3/4 of the central charge that we computed in gravity. Okay. So two things to note about that. One is, well, first of all, square root of 3/4 is less than 1. So the central charge at n equals 4. So central charge at weak coupling is actually less than the central charge at strong coupling. Okay, so it's actually the inverse of how it is from, go ahead.
I'm very confused about this, because the central charge at n equals 4 is for four-dimensional theory. But here the equation is for two-dimensional theory. So how am I supposed to actually think of them as being remotely related in sense of the CD theorem or anything like that. It's just some.
So if you'd like, what you can do is think of putting n equals 4 on T2, okay, where the magnetic flux lines are filling the T2. And then what I'm doing is I'm computing the central charge, the resulting 1 plus 1 dimensional theory that remains. Okay. So, I think if I put it on T2, then I have one space dimension left, so there's some CFT there. You don't look happy with that answer.
No, I'm not happy.
Oh, okay.
I'll complain later.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm not seeing the.
And what did you compute in the bulk? What did you mean by central charge of ADS in this context? You said Brown and Hanover, but is there an ADS3 in this problem?
Yeah. So I said I exhibited for you here a solution is ADS3 times R2.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Right. And so I just there's a good old ADS3, plain vanilla ADS3. I just compute central charge ADS3 as per usual.
At this point, there's no entropy.
No. This is ADS3. This is just I'm looking at the vacuum of the theory, and I'm probing excitations above the vacuum via, I can do the central charge. That's going to really tell me something about excitations. But yeah, no entropy at this stage. Yeah, everything's zero temperature right now. Okay. Three-quarters there. You may be familiar with some other places that three-quarters appear. This three-quarters seems to have no relation to the other famous three-quarters. And in fact, there'll be several other three-quarters that appear for other unrelated reasons, which is very, very possible. Yeah.
Let me ask the question again. Is the speed of light the same in infrared as in the beam? Because that presumably tells you something about it.
I have Lorentz invariants along the B field. Okay, so everything is totally Lorentz invariant along parallel to B. So I can't do Lorentz transformations of the directions. I don't have a symmetry, so I don't even know what to.
Sorry, your bulk metric ansatz preserve the Lorentz invariants? Not clear from that
part. No, I'm about to say this a second. This is the general ansatz for finite temperature, which are both Lorentz invariants. So when saying the theory, I was essentially saying the theory itself preserves Lorentz invariants. Of course, I excited the finite temperature, that would break it. But in fact, this ties into my next slide here. Very well. So I now look for solutions and interpolate. So I'm trying to say that this ADS3 times R2 is the IR, describes the IR of the theory, which was given by this 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, and I want to interpolate between the ADS3 out to ADS5. Okay, so the first thing you can look for, the simplest solutions, are zero temperature solutions. Now, zero temperature, based on nothing else on the CFT intuition, you expect boost invariance along the direction of B. So B is pointing in the 3 direction, you're at zero temperature, that's boost invariant. So I'll write down a boost invariant ansatz that kills one function. Previously I had an independent function in front of x3, so I have this guy. Now you can try to solve this analytically. You can't do it very easily, but numerically there's a unique such solution. It's unique because the only parameter here is b, but b is dimensionful, and so this is a CFT, so there's nothing to compare it to, so there's really no independent scale there. So there's a unique numerical solution. And what does this represent? Well, claim is it represents the RG flow between the 3 plus 1 dimensional n equals 4 theory in the UV and the 1 plus 1 dimensional theory of the fermions in the IR. Okay, so now let's turn on temperature. Okay, so now we want to, the near horizon should be at least a very parametrically low temperature, would be a BTZ solution. And again, we want to go to ADS5. So now we have two parameters, temperature and magnetic field. So we have one dimensionless combination, so I'm going to have a one parameter family of solutions. And so, okay, so you can fix the gauge freedom of the problem. You can choose a value of this ratio, essentially, and integrate out. And you can numerically find smooth solutions for all values of this ratio. And then you can plot the entropy versus temperature. And you can also compare, so you can take the free n equals 4 theory at finite magnetic field and just work out the partition function, just evaluate that, all those sums over lambda levels and this and that, and work out a corresponding curve, and then compare them. And we're comparing here dimensionless entropies and sort of natural gauge theory units and a dimensionless temperature. It doesn't make sense to be comparing dimensionful quantities here. So at high temperatures, so this is temperature, this is entropy. At high temperatures, you have this thing here. And so the red is gravity, blue is n equals 4. And of course, they differ by 3/4. This is the famous 3/4 discrepancy, differing by 3/4, both going like T³. Then at low energies, both entropies are going linear in temperature. In fact, they're controlled by the central charge that we computed before, but we saw there's a different central charge in gravity in the free theory, differing by this fourth square root of 4/3 factor. So indeed, I mean, the entropies differ by precisely this factor, and you can just, I mean, this, these lines we can be numerically definitely, their slope is differing by the square root of 4/3. Okay, so it's kind of amusing. One thing that's sort of amusing is you actually get, in the sense that square root of 3/4 is closer to 1 than 3/4, you actually get a better agreement here with the magnetic field present at low temperature than you would have without the magnetic field. So that's kind of amusing.
So the lines cross at some temperature?
They cross at some temperature.
Is there anything interesting happening there?
Not that I know of, yeah. I don't, yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't see anything interesting.
You're comparing a free calculation with very strongly coupled calculations.
Yeah, well, that's why it's 3/4.
That's right. Yeah, unless you're happy that you get a number as close to 1 as you do. Yeah, but also this, the point is now you sort of know essentially what's going on here. You know what's controlling entropy here. It's these fermions. Okay, so now we want to add charge to the theory. So I want to look at solution with non-zero temperature, magnetic field, and charge. Okay, so the one approach you could do is to first ask, let's ask about small magnetic field. So I could start from the purely charged black brain solution and try to perturbatively add magnetic field to that. Okay, and you can do this. It works out beautifully as long as you're at high enough temperature. So in fact, I mean, you can solve this problem analytically. You can just go order by order in B and just integrate and find the explicit metric perturbations and everything in closed form. And in fact, it's directly analogous to this kind of ADS fluid dynamics approach that's been worked a lot in the recent years. And the reason is basically the same is that a small magnetic field is basically a slowly varying gauge field. And what this whole approach of these authors is based on is some sort of derivative expansion. So you have slowly varying fields, long wavelength perturbations of black brains seem always to be kind of integrable type equations in the bulk. On the other hand, one thing we're interested in is low temperatures. And if you start trying to push this perturbation theory to low temperatures, you find that the expansion parameter involves things roughly like B over T squared. Some of the things depend on the charge as well. But one way or another, perturbation theory breaks down at low temperature. So you try to add magnetic field to the extremal charged brain. Well, you can't do that in perturbation theory. You could go the other route. You could start from this numerically constructed solution that had just magnetic field and no charge, and now try to add so that ADS3, solution from the near horizon ADS3, try to add on some small charge to that in perturbation theory. But that also fails, except for this very special value of K, which I'll mention in a second. You find some sort of strange power laws in the metric, and you differentiate these enough times, it leads to some sort of singularities. Okay, so generally, you cannot approach this problem at low temperatures through perturbation theory. Okay, so again, you have to go numerical. And the first step, again, is to try to find some sort of near-horizon, candidate near-horizon geometry that you can then integrate out to infinity from. Okay, so you look for some extremal solution, some zero-temperature near-horizon solution playing the role of ADS3. And what you find very quickly is that, except for the special case of k equal to 1, where the Chern-Simons level has a special value, which is not the supersymmetric value, you find there are no solutions. You simply cannot put in like this U function that was basically GTT. If you try to have that be a double zero, you just find that's inconsistent with the other equations if they're sufficiently smoothly behaved and so forth. Okay, and so one thing this shows is that the magnetic field kills the ADS2 near horizon solution of the purely charged case. I mean, it's no longer a solution. That's easy enough to check. Okay, now, indeed, something very special happens precisely at k equal to 1. For that case, in that case only, you do find a simple near-horizon solution carrying electric field and magnetic field, and it's written this thing out here. And so you have to say k equal to 1, and you have to have E squared and B squared satisfy that condition. Okay, so what are these things? Well, let's look at two special limits. So first of all, if I turn off the magnetic field, set B equal to 0, and then E equal to square root of 6, so that I kill that term, and then you can see that this and that are precisely ADS2, and then times the R3. So of course I get back the purely charged ADS2 times R3 near horizon solution. Or you can go to the other extreme and set equal to 0 and keep B, get rid of this term, then you have this guy, and this is some slightly non-standard parametrization of, well, it's locally ADS3 in fact. So again, as expected, you get back ADS3 times R2. But in general, you have, if you go along general generic solutions of this equation, you have some family of solutions which interpolate between ADS2 and ADS3. What are these things? Well, in fact, these actually are certain warped ADS3 black hole solutions that were studied by a number of people. Stromberger et al. And Jeffrey and Stefan helped me actually identify this. And so there they were found as solutions of topologically massive gravity, gravity with the Chern-Simons terms and higher derivative theory of gravity. But here you see they just come out of five-dimensional Chern-Simons theory. And so, in fact, these kind of near horizon warped solutions then sort of naturally get fit into some four-dimensional gauge theory framework because you can flow between these things and some ADS5 solution. Okay, so that's kind of interesting.
When you say that these only exist at k equal to 1, is that just when k isn't 1 that it's singular at the horizon? Or
yeah, if you try to look for some zero temperature solution, it'll be singular at the horizon, yeah.
Is it also true for k equals 0?
Yeah, that's true for k equal to 0 as well.
Yeah. Is k equal to 0 a special point, or does it behave in general like?
In this context, k equals 0 is not that special from this perspective. Yeah. So what happens at k equal to 1, if you sort of view things as some space times some R2, and you try to compactify in the R2, then there's some scalar field corresponding to that volume modulus, and then it has some potential, and then precisely this k equal to 1 point, the potential just becomes flat. Otherwise, it has some runaway behavior, and the scalar runs away and singularizes it.
So I mean, you're always looking at homogeneous solutions.
Yeah.
Right. And I kind of remember Hiroshi and collaborators last fall studied the same theory, right?
Yeah.
They found these inhomogeneous solutions.
Right.
So
That was at k, only for k larger than the supersymmetric value. So that's if you take k sufficiently large, that happens. Here I'm actually lower than the supersymmetric value. Supersymmetric value is actually 1.15 something, blah 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 blah. So I'm below that. So yeah, but that's right. If especially large k, then other instabilities. And of course, in general, I should in principle be looking for, if I could, spatially inhomogeneous solutions as well. I mean, that right. But I'm.
So is it possible to compute the similar chart associated with interwarped ADS3 in the same way you did it for one and one ADS3?
Yeah, well, not directly. I mean, I think, I don't know the answer to that. It's an interesting question.
And only at E equals, what's the horizon area? Is it non-zero?
Yeah, no, there's a non-zero horizon area. So the entry, it's only zero if you set E equal to zero. Yeah. Okay. Right, so in general, now we have to go numerical. In general, we don't even know sort of what the near horizon solution, if it exists, what it is. So we have to just sort of put boundary conditions sort of at some finite temperature horizon and integrate out. And we're going to have a two-parameter family of solutions because we have three dimensionful parameters, two dimensionless combinations. So we write down basically a general ansatz. Okay, so we have now functions U, V, W, C, and then in the gauge field we have the electric field. This is constant by Bianchi identity, but then some other P function. Okay, and so we assume there's some horizon at some location R plus, so we assume that U vanishes, and then, okay, there's the Hawking temperature given by the derivative. So this solution is stationary, no T's, but it's not static. There's cross terms here. And this is due to the combined effect of the charge, the magnetic field, and the Chern-Simons term, which together breaks time reversal. Okay. So there's a few slides on technicalities here, just to see how the sausage is made. We're doing these numerically, so we have to, choose our coordinates to boil things down to the free parameters and integrate out. So we set the horizon to be at 1. We can scale time coordinates such that the temperature is basically 1. The electric field of the horizon, the magnetic field of the horizon, we call little q and little b. Okay, and then we can set all these functions here. Well, this one's 0 by the assumption there's a horizon. But all these guys, by scaling coordinates appropriately, we can set them equal to 0. Okay, that actually still leaves one gauge freedom. This function p here is still, you can still fix its value at the horizon. You can change it by doing some boost. And in fact, eventually, so you have to choose the value of this thing judiciously to avoid coordinate singularities. So I just want to mention that. This will come back later. Okay. Right, so now you want some asymptotically ADS5 solution. That was, again, the ansatz. So asymptotically ADS5, these functions will all go out to some canonical power laws, and there'll be some coefficients here. So in turn, e to the 2v, some coefficient we call v, some coefficient w. These are all numbers which, in principle, are computable numerically in terms of the initial data. So the initial data was specified by little q and little b, the electric charge and magnetic field. You compute all the asymptotics in terms of those two things. That should give you all the information about the solution, you know, all the, well, everything should be expressed in terms of those quantities eventually. There's technical reasons why we combine E and CP together like that. Okay, so you evaluate out. Now what you really want to compare with CFT is you want to have the CFT basically in, you want to compare things in the rest frame. So we have, since this is a non-stationary geometry, things can start boosting away from you, and you want to sort of always be in the rest frame. So you have to do some explicit Lorentz transformations to sort of bring yourself back to the rest frame. That's why there are various gamma factors that appear here. But anyway, there's some, you know, doing all this boosting and rescaling, this and that. Eventually, you can express all the physical quantities, like the temperature, the physical magnetic field, because there was some rescaling in space. This is the magnetic field that the CFT would see, and the charge density, and entropy, and so on. Okay. So eventually, everything's sort of in CFT units per proper volume element in the rest frame, etc. Well, this is sort of an aside, but one thing that happens, there's actually some current, electric current flowing parallel to the magnetic field that you can work on expression for, and then you re-express in terms of the chemical potential. It's a simple formula. This is basically the chiral anomaly, and this is related to the chiral magnetic effect that people have discussed. If you're at finite chemical potential and you have a magnetic field, and you have a system with anomalies, that will drive some current. So you can use this to evaluate those things. Okay, now what do we want to do with this thing? We'd like to do is basically think of physically fixing the magnetic field and the charge density, and then think of asking how things depend on temperature. How does the entropy depend on temperature? Okay, but fixing in the magnetic field and the charge density themselves are dimensionful, so we really mean we fix B and Q is we fix their dimensionless ratio. So I want to fix the dimensionless ratio of B and Q and then change the temperature, go to zero, and see how the entropy is behaving. Okay, so if you want to change the temperature while keeping this thing constant, you have to start adjusting the parameters labeling a solution, named little q and little b, and so you have to make them evolve to keep this thing constant as you change t. And so what these blue lines show is the flows heading towards lower temperature. Okay, so you start at some particular temperature, lower the temperature to flow in this qb space to lower and lower temperature. Okay, and so where do you end up? Well, let's first look at the special k equal to 1 case. That was the one case where we had some candidate near horizon finite entropy solutions. Okay, these are these warped ADS3 black holes. And so this curve here is precisely what I said before, that you had to specify the special E squared plus 2B squared equals 6. That's what this curve is. And indeed, as you go to low temperature, you precisely flow into these solutions. So as you expect, at low temperatures, you flow to these extremal warped ADS3 black holes that you saw. And that makes perfect sense. Then things differ very much depending on whether you're K less than 1 or K greater than 1. If you're in K less than 1, you actually flow, these flows all end up, as far as we can tell, flowing towards no magnetic field, but non-zero electric field. They're basically heading towards the purely electrically charged brain solution, the Reisner-Nordström solution.
But wait a minute, B is fixed in infinity. So little b is some magnetic field at the horizon?
Yeah.
So you're turning it off initially, but it's still there at
infinity. Yeah, so it depends, things depend very sensibly on the angle that you come in here. Yeah, so even though there's large sort of shifts, rescalings between little b and big B, and so even though little b is going to zero, I can nevertheless keep this thing fixed, and things depend sensibly on the angle that I come in into this point. Yeah, this is a sort of confusing point, but you just see it numerically. It's. Over here, it's the opposite. Now we flow down to this fixed point with zero q and non-zero b. And again, same token, even though little q is going to zero, nevertheless, you can keep this thing fixed as long as you tune in to a very precise angle, very precise trajectory. And it gets, numerically, it gets more and more difficult to do that as you get to lower and lower temperature to come in just at the right angle to keep this thing constant and get temperature to go low. Okay. Yeah, we actually don't know. It's possible these curves actually terminate somewhere here on this. So they're all getting asymptotically closer and closer to these red curves, and it's even possible you end up at one of them. But at some point you get so close and the numerics get so hard, you can't really ever conclusively tell. But yeah, this is valid over some large range. Okay, so now that you have those, now you can look at how the entropy behaves with temperature. And so let's first consider the case where K was less than or equal to 1. So that was, well, let's take this case in particular, where you're flowing to the warped ADS3 black holes. That's what you expect. Now there is a candidate black hole at zero temperature and non-zero entropy. And so you can plot entropy versus temperature, suitably dimensionless. And indeed, you can see that it flows down to some non-zero entropy. And what I'm doing here is I'm comparing this against the purely electrically charged solution with no B. So I'm putting the same plot here so you can sort of compare magnitudes. And I'm fixing some particular value of magnetic field, 0.15. Okay, so for this particular value, the entropy goes down about half of what it was before. By dialing this suitably, I can basically dial the entropy anywhere in this region because I can basically go anywhere along this curve that I want.
Can I ask, yeah. Is there some sense in which K is increasing the dimension of some operator? Because it seems like when K is less than 1, you're flowing into this.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's irrelevant.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, that sounds intuitively very nice. I'm trying to make that more. I mean, if you change K, you're somewhat changing what the whole boundary CFT is. So I don't. But in terms of these flows, it indeed looks like that. But I don't know how to make it more precise than that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So indeed, and for any value of K less than 1, you basically get the same picture. The entropy comes in and flows down to some finite value. Okay, so now here's the case at the supersymmetric value. And so this is the story as we understood it back in November, and this is actually some basically transparency I had back then. So again, we fix that same value of B, and what happens is you lower the temperature, eventually the entropy looks like it's coming down. You could even sort of extrapolate, look like it's heading down to zero. But at some point we ran into some sort of weird, things kind of looked like they're becoming singular in some way, various numbers are going into infinity, didn't really know what was going on, and we certainly didn't find any nice solutions over here, but nevertheless, it's inconsistent, the entropy would go going to zero if we went far enough. But, the key point turned out to be that we were doing everything in that paper in this special choice of gauge where this p function we set to zero is the most natural value. But it turns out if you want to go to lower temperature, you really have to tune this thing. You don't want to keep it at zero, you have to tune it, and so now we can do much better. So now if we allow ourselves to tune the gauge choice, and you have to tune it finer and finer precision to go lower and lower temperature, but now we can really follow this curve all the way down. It's completely clear that it's just going down to zero entropy. Okay, and you can get this as small as you want. So for this value of the magnetic field kills the ground state entropy, and it goes to zero. Okay, now let's look into that a bit more. Let's sort of focus on.
For the supersymmetric value of K?
This is for the supersymmetric value of K, yeah.
And if you're slightly below that, it doesn't happen? Do you need to be at the supersymmetric value for this?
K equal to 1 is kind of the borderline. Yeah, that's right.
Above K equals 1.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to. That's what we've seen defined, but it's, yeah. Yeah, that's the belief. No, the nearest geography is not anything natural. I mean, so we said there couldn't be any candidate. It's not clear what it is, actually. It's becoming some sort of mild singularity is developing, but it's very, very, very mild. I don't know how to characterize it, actually. So you see this thing numerically with all these functions and boosted and this and that. It's not so easy just to look at this thing and say, aha, this is, you know.
It's not just a scalar curvature blowing through.
No, it's actually some component like the Maxwell field kind of starts having a very mild divergence. Yeah.
So F squared?
No, actually F squared is finite. But if you look at some freely falling observer and the norm, that kind of thing, which I did check, that does become infinite. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at the very low temperature regime. Okay, so that same kind of curve at low temperature, what you find, if you plot this, you find it extremely good accuracy. The entropy is linear in temperature, okay, exactly as you want. And so, right, so this is indeed, this is Fermi liquid behavior, and that matches up nicely, but this is in the region where it's relatively, we said that the system was flowing down to a system of fermions, given by the fermion zero modes. Now, of course, we're at finite charge, so things are changing, but, if things were being governed by fermions, then So we add in charge, we're filling up some, you know, Fermi levels and so on. And so S going like T is precisely what you'd want, and that indeed matches up. And you can see we're down to very low entropies here, 10 to the minus 6 dimensionless units. Okay, so S is going like some portion of the T, so there's gonna be some coefficient. And so it's interesting to ask how that coefficient is changing as you change B. So now we're going to T equal to 0, S is going linear in T, but I'm going to flash some things, but I'll summarize here in a second. So if you get lost in all the various regions, I'll summarize here. Okay, so the proportionality constant depends on B, and in fact, it diverges linearly at some critical value of B. So the entropy at low temperatures here is actually behaving like this. So here's the data, so this is a log plot. And well, this curve, this line is actually slope 1. And so this is really saying that you're getting this behavior, and then you can compute critical value of B to very good precision. And if that number means anything to you, please let me know.
So that's B critical in where Q squared is 1 or something?
Yeah, I actually read this. At this point, it would say Q equal to 1. Yeah, this could, yeah. Right. Okay. Okay, so there's a critical value of B, and then, of course, the interesting thing to do would be to sit right at that critical value of B, if you could. So let's set, to our best numerical accuracy, B equal to B critical, and then see what the entropy does as I change the temperature. So again, we plot some log plot, and now you get a nice straight line and a power that's basically 0.33, which one strongly suspects is 1/3. Okay, so S going like T. I mean, you can't, it's... This gets very sensitive. I can't, you know, if you ask me to get this to 8 decimal places, you know, no way. But anyway, you'll see why. There's a good reason to believe it's 0.33. Okay, so critical value B, S goes like 2 to the 1/3. Okay, but now, if we go below that, decrease B even more, now suddenly we do find entropy. We do find entropy at non-zero temperature for all B less than that. So here is that critical value B. Here we're down at zero temperature, decrease B less than that. There simply is a well-defined entropy curve. So this initial statement that you might have thought I was making, where we sort of conjectured in one of our papers that arbitrarily small B field would kill the entropy. Okay, no, that doesn't, I mean, it was conjecture, and there's the counterexample.
So the first curve you showed us when you said you had to introduce this function P, and then you could extrapolate down to the entropy to 0, that was assuming B bigger than this critical value?
It was assuming B bigger than that critical value, that's right. But we're running into some gauge singularity, some coordinate singularity there. Yeah, it was bigger than that dot. Okay. And so then the interesting behavior then is how the entropy goes to 0 at this critical value B, and then you can just put in the numbers here and you find the excellent approximation of some square root behavior as you approach that from below. Okay, so let me summarize all these different limits now. So here's a summary of the thermodynamics. We're from the low temperature thermodynamics, and I'm saying it depends sensitively on the magnetic field. So off at large magnetic field, you take the temperature down to 0, S goes linear in T. Continues to go linear in T as you reduce B, but now the coefficient starts to diverge. You sit right at the critical value B, go down to temperature, S goes like T to the 1/3. Go for B less than B critical. Now there's ground state entropy going like square root of B critical minus B, at least if you're close to this point.
And again, this is for generic K greater than 1?
To be honest, we've only done this for one value of K. What I very strongly suspect is the only thing that changes if you change K is the value of B critical.
This is all the supersymmetric value?
This is the supersymmetric value, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I it would be unlikely. Well, yeah, I think BC will change, but not.
For the case k less than 1, do you also get this vanishing into critical value of B, or is that?
Actually, I don't completely know the answer to that. For k equal to 1, you can take arbitrarily large B and get non, and no, the entropy asymptotically goes to 0. So for k less than 1, actually, I don't, that's a good question. Actually, I don't know the answer to that.
Basically, for k less than 1, you always have a finite ground state entropy.
It looks like it. For the flow diagrams, it looks like it for arbitrarily. I just don't know if it's parametrically. But if that picture I do is correct, indeed. Yeah, no, I think you would. For arbitrarily large B, indeed, I think you'll have non-zero entropies. That hasn't really been checked. Okay. All right, so what's going on here? Okay, so metamagnetic quantum criticality. Okay, so that's a nice word. What does it mean? Okay. So I mean, just a bit of background here, and you'll see why I think this is related to what we're seeing. So this is what I'm starting by explaining here is a finite temperature metamagnetic transition. Okay, so a metamagnetic phase transition is basically analogous to a liquid vapor phase transition in the sense that it's some generically first order phase transition where there's no change in symmetry. In liquid vapor, of course, the density changes. Here it's the magnetization which jumps as you cross some line, but it doesn't change the symmetry. And just like a liquid vapor phase transition, there's a first order curve that ends at some point at some second order critical point. Okay, and this is consistent with there being no change of symmetry because you can wander around from this side to that side. Okay, and now what you'd like to do to get into quantum criticality is to try to bring this critical temperature down to zero. Because then you have a critical point at zero temperature, quantum critical. Okay, and this is what it, I mean. As I mentioned, the very last transparency. I mean, there are now systems where they can do this. They can bring this thing down, study these metamagnetic quantum critical points. Right, okay, so you scale that thing down, you reach the critical point. Okay, so now is, well, a lot of discussion of this sort of thing recently, so I don't have to say too much. But so at that point, now we have some scale invariant quantum field theory. And what is the relevant data here for this thing? Well, first of all, I can move off this critical point by changing B. And so B is some coupling, and it's multiplying some relevant operator. And then actually I can move in B, and then I can move off the critical point here by changing the temperature. And so then the thermodynamics near that critical point is going to be controlled by two numbers. You just need to know the dimension of that coupling delta B. And this is a non-relativistic system in general, so you need to know the dynamical critical exponent. Of course, so here when I cut dimensions, I'm thinking of rescaling space, and then Z gives me the relative rescaling of time, which you can then think about as being the dimension of temperature, the scaling dimension of temperature. Okay, so then you have these parameters, you know their dimensions, and so you just write down the most general formula for the entropy consistent with being dimensionally correct. So, B minus B critical to 1 over delta B now has the same dimensions as T to the 1 over Z, so I can have any function of that thing. And then, T D over Z multiplies L to the D to give a dimensionless quantity. Okay, so then you get one of these sort of famous pictures that people have probably gotten sick of by now, but there's one more version of it. So near the critical point here, this scaling form of the entropy is going to control the thermodynamics everywhere sufficiently close. If you get too far away from the critical point, there'd be some other irrelevant operators in your theory which you'd have to take into account. But sufficiently close, everything's controlled by this fixed point. And then there's this fan that people draw all the time. So this is just a statement that if B is sufficiently near BC, then you're being controlled by basically the argument of the F function is near zero. Okay, so if the argument of the function is near zero, that's when you can just forget about this relevant coupling. And so you have this region up here, and then, well, at some point the argument of this function becomes of order 1, and so that's when T to the 1 over Z becomes B minus B critical of 1 over delta B, so that's what this curve is here. And so these two regions here, we change over one asymptotics of F over to the other asymptotics. Okay. Okay, so that all matches, that story there matches with our system, just in the second year. If you put in Z equal to 3, dynamical critical exponent 3, the dimension of that magnetic field changing operator equal to 2, and then we're in one dimension here. We effectively just have one dimension going critical because the fermion and zero modes are living in one dimension. Okay, so then all these scalings about the entropy that I talked about before just turn into some statements about the asymptotics of this F function. Okay, so some certain asymptotics of various regions control the entropy over here, the entropy over here, and the entropy over there. Okay, and so you can check that. Okay, now what does this mean? Why are we getting Z equal to 3, delta B equal to 2? In fact, there is kind of a classic description of quantum critical metamagnetism, which is why one of the main reasons why I think this is connected. So you start from some, this dates back, this is like 76, and this is like in 93 or so. So you start with some system of fermions with spin couplings, and then you introduce some auxiliary fields, convert to a theory of bosons and so forth, and get some effective action for the bosons. And when you integrate out the fermions, psi here is a boson. That was a poor choice of Greek letter. But you integrate out the fermions, and you actually get some 1 over k. This is momentum behavior showing up. And you can just do this from one loop calculations. And so this is the kind of action that you get. okay, here in one spatial dimension. And you can just now read off the various parameters here. So you can see that I have an omega over k and a k squared. So that means omega and k cubed have the same dimension. And that tells you right away that z equal to 3. And then b minus b critical is the same dimension as k squared. That tells you the dimension of this guy is 2. And then we're in one dimension. And so then you can play some fun games. Okay, so you can take this action, it's just as a free field theory, sort of slightly unconventional looking free field theory, and just work out the free field entropy from this thing. Okay, and so you work out the free field entropy, it's guaranteed to go into the scaling form because all the inputs are there. But then you can work out the F function, then you can compare with what you get in gravity for the corresponding F function, and you can plot them. And so here's, so the asymptotics are kind of guaranteed to work based on whatever we said. So you can ask yourself, is there more matching here than the asymptotics? Well, I don't exactly know. I haven't really actually gone any pains to make these look similar. I just grabbed, the scales are even different, so I could adjust things here to make it look better. But anyway, now the difference, the reason, so there's a lot going on that's clearly being well described by this action. But this action cannot be the whole story for our theory. And the reason is, everything I'm describing over here is, you see, x greater than 0. That's when b is greater than b critical, that's when the system was being driven to zero entropy. Of course, the black hole, we said it'd be less than b critical, had a non-zero ground state entropy. And there's no way this thing is going to give you a ground state entropy. So if you continued, you really have an absolute value here in the field theory, so you should really take this curve here and basically just make it symmetric. No, sorry, this one over here. Make it symmetric. Whereas this guy here, you can now continue for, I mean, I haven't plotted it here, but you can just take this curve and just continue it over here. You'll get some sort of square root x behavior. And so these things look very similar for positive in one quadrant, but then start differing. So the gravity version is this plus maybe, I don't know, some extra degrees of freedom or something. It's an interesting question, but it's doing some things right. Okay, finally, the real world. So, well, there's been a lot of interesting experiments over the last few years and on this quantum critical metamagnetism. They do precisely what I was describing before. And particularly, there's been a lot of experiments with one particular compound. Don't start asking me any details about this, but the strontium ruthenate. And in this paper from last year, I mean, they can actually map out the whole entropy as a function of temperature and magnetic field for this compound at low temperatures. And so you can get a whole, the word landscape actually appears in there in the title of their paper. This is the entropic landscape, that's their words. So here are a couple of plots. And one thing you can see here, so this is, entropy is basically the same as heat capacity. They're both the same thing here. And so this is, you're going near this critical AB, and then you can see that the entropy is spiking up, starting to diverge. And in fact, it diverges exactly the same way that we had. It goes like temperature over B minus B critical. The scaling with temperature, I mean, they actually have some Fermi liquid over here and over here, so that's why it's going like the temperature. But the fact that it goes like 1 over B minus BC is actually not so easy to explain. I don't think there actually is a good explanation. I'm not claiming to explain it either. It may just be some sort of coincidence, but it's interesting that same dependence appears. The characteristics are kind of similar. There's obviously some very funny stuff happening inside here. So the reds are extrapolations. Inside here, you have this. The kind of words they use is they're going towards some of this magnetic quantum critical point where the entropy seems to be increasing. And they say, well, but we know the entropy can't be non-zero at zero temperature. Something has to happen. And what actually happens is you seem to enter this thing called this pneumatic phase, this electronic spin liquid, they call it, where you actually break some rotational symmetry. So you actually break some symmetry. And that's sort of the compound solution to developing a non-zero entropy. Okay, but anyway, this is some, it's kind of interesting to see the same kind of things being done. Okay, so yeah, actually I'm about done here. Yeah, for them it's basically symmetric here. So you can see here, this is the data, or here if you like, and B critical is just right in the middle here, and things are basically symmetric on the two sides. Yeah, so in our case, of course, things are highly non-symmetric. But we have this black hole, so we have this side over here, replaced by this black hole, but one can then speculate, just like for them, there was some transition that broke spatial translations and so on, you know, perhaps, and that's not put into our ansatz, so perhaps there is something like that that would happen to our black hole as well. Okay, right, so that basically comes to the summary. Okay, so we obtained this numerically solutions corresponding to three plus one dimensional gauge theories of finite temperature, charge, magnetic field. Any non-zero magnetic field seemed to remove this ADS2 region from the purely charged solution, replaced it by something else, which depended on the details. The neutral solution, no charge, described this RG flow from the 3 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory in the UV down to the 1 plus 1 dimensional theory of the fermions in the IR, and everything sort of, you can make things match up to this numerical factor of square root of 3/4. And then we added charge and magnetic field. We saw this interesting T equals 0 critical point, which seems to have some of the same properties as this metamagnetic quantum criticality. And I'll stop there.
So at the end, when you were talking about all this, the phase diagram and the interesting thing, there was dependence on everything but Q. What was Q doing here? I mean, had this T and the entropy and the B and the...
Yeah, okay, so Q, I mean, so I'm forming dimensionless combinations. Everything is divided by Q. So at some point, I just said effectively Q equal to 1. I sort of lost it in my formulas. But you can set, if you like, you can say Q equal to 1 just by scaling. So,
okay.
Yeah. There's really.
But then when you have this function of F, and you argue that that was the right ratio because of dimensions, right? You had some formula where you argued that there was a dimensionless combination in the argument of F. But if you have another dimensionful parameter in Q, then it's not true that that's the only way of combining B and
The point is that the original dimensional analysis was from the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory, where B and Q and so forth had certain dimensions, and there I formed dimensionless combination. Now I'm at some new fixed point here. I'm at a completely different fixed point, so there's some new dimensional analysis going on at the new fixed point. That's what I'm using here. And so the point is, the statement is I only have, I guess just from one of these flows here, in the theory, I could just move in this direction or this direction. There's nothing.
And you're not changing
else.
Q.
It's.
Another direction? You could think of this as being T over Q and B over Q.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, I've said exactly. Everything is. Yeah, I've set. I just got tired of writing Q, so I set them equal to 1 at some point, but that's what's going on. Yeah.
My turn again.
Okay.
You have these two central charges, which in one was on the ADS 4 and the other one was on the ADS 3, and for some reason the one on the ADS 3 is bigger than the one on ADS 4.
Yeah, that was right at the back of the beginning here.
And now we're talking about two 1 plus 1 field theories, right? Because you compactified the four-dimensional theory in the two torus.
Yep.
And now the semi-logical theorem does apply, and then there's the issue that the central charge seems to be going up rather than down. That would be a problem.
Wait. There's no. I'm not doing any RG flow between two 1 plus 1 dimensional theories. The only RG flow going on is between the 3 plus 1 dimensional theory and the 1 plus 1 in the.
Yeah, it's a 3 plus 1 field theory on a torus, and measuring using a 3 plus 1 a torus gives you a 1 plus 1 field theory with a lot of luck. So
okay.
should be a central charge there, some stress tensor correlator, and then the central charge has a meaning, if, at least that's the way I understand it. So that so unless there's some extra thing I'm missing here, this should be covered by the semi-logical theorem.
Well, you didn't really compute the exact central charge of the 1 plus 1 dimensional reduction of A equals 4, you did a free theory estimate.
Yeah, right. No, this is free field. There's no
calculation.
Well, there's gravity. I've never computed, as Don says, the. I'm taking the free field limit of n equals 4.
Oh,
that's one thing.
There's no objection. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, of course, I can't.
Apples to oranges.
Yeah. There's no way I can compute the the strong coupling central charge.
Well, in principle, because it's an anomaly, right?
No, it isn't an anomaly. No, it's non-supersymmetric. No.
No, but it's a stress tensor curve.
Okay, but that's not protected by anything. That's not protected by anything.
You can compute a bulk gravity solution if you had.
No, from gravity, yeah, but I'm saying in field theory, if you ask me to compute.
No, that's right. So you have the ADS3 part, and you have the, in principle, the stress tensor correlator of the gravity side.
Yeah, that's what I mean, effectively, by computing CADS, I've effectively computed that from the gravity stress tensor correlator. That's equivalent to what I've done.
Yeah, but you did it for the ADS3 there.
Yeah.
But you can also do it for the periodic ADS5.
Yeah, but you get the same thing. I mean, it's just because this is the IR solution of that theory.
No, it's just periodically identifying ADS5, right?
Yeah, I mean, out in infinity, this thing's asymptotic. If I compactify two directions, then asymptotically, this thing is ADS5 with two directions compactified. That's what the solution is.
Is there a way to just remove the ADS3 at the bottom or leave something that's really...
To remove the ADS. So I mean, I don't understand.
You just want to calculate the central charge of the ADS5 affected by the torus at zero magnetic and electric charge.
Yeah.
Well, zero magnetic. Okay, but yeah.
I mean, otherwise I don't understand what I guess from the top is just strictly theory.
Well, there's something to compare. I mean, this is the same kind of comparison we do for, you know, finite temperature D3 brains. I'm not saying you have to match. I mean, I'm not saying, yeah. I mean, this is exactly analogous to the finite temperature D3 brains. All the same statements apply.
Yeah, what I mean is that it doesn't compare in the sense of having a UV flow or like margin flow or something like that. Okay. I mean, when you have RG flows from one supergravity solution to another one, it makes sense to compare them to central charges. There's usually a C theorem that tells you that it goes in one direction.
Yeah, I mean, here the dimension is changing. That's the key thing. I'm flowing from an ADS5 solution down to something which is actually compactified. So it's an RG flow across dimensions. So you can't actually use some of the standard things you're used to.
Questions?